You're about to hear the story of hope, resilience, and the pure emotion of managing to cope when your baby is premature. From entering the unknown to the gritty determination of showing up every single day for 72 days when normal life simply has to continue. This is 72 Days with Liam Back.
You go through all these usual steps of becoming a parent, but not at any point do you think, what if it comes 12 weeks early?
I was on my own in a birthing room. There's no missus, no baby. And that's probably the most lost I've ever felt in life. Hey dads, welcome to the latest episode of the Dadversity podcast. I am joined by Leeds fan, pro golfer, insurance expert, Liam. How are you?
Maybe not even one out of three.
One out of three, not bad, is it?
I'll take that, mate. Yeah, very good. Thanks for having me. Looking forward to it.
No, me too. It's been... So there's a couple of things I know we spoke about before we hit record that I'm going to cover today. We met on LinkedIn. I think one of the things that got my attention about you was actually your job. And we've gone back and forward on this and spoken about the perception of it and how exciting it is to speak about. But you basically do life insurance for dads, right?
Yeah.
Or for everyone, for families, but we use it through the lens of dads for the sake of the podcast. And so that was when we initially got connected, and then we started to talk more about you and family life and got onto this really interesting topic that we've never ever covered before on Dadversity, which is weird because there's another dad in the community who speaks a lot about having premature kids. It's a massive moment, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so we then got onto that topic after discovering your background in life insurance. And yeah, I thought it'd be cool just to have a chat and cover like both of those things. And just hopefully give dad some value around life insurance, what it involves, what are some of the pitfalls they need to look at. But then also talking about your experience as a dad who's had premature little one and has gone through that sort of process, because that's, I imagine, we'll get into it, but I imagine a pretty stressful time, right?
Yeah, God, yeah, mate. Yeah, it's one of them things where when you first get pregnant, you start thinking about, or we started thinking about, okay, what do we want to decorate the nursery like? What names are we going to have? What do we need to buy that we've not got already? You go through all these usual steps of becoming a parent, but not at any point do you think, what if it comes 12 weeks early?
Yeah.
Then what do we do? Because there's no kind of precursor. And that's to this day, there's loads of research goes into premature birth. And to this day, like, there's no real strong precursors as to what happens. I think 90,000 babies a year come before 37 weeks, which is considered kind of a preterm birth. But obviously, the further behind that 37-week period you are, the more serious the implications can be because the baby's less developed. So Eliza came at 28 weeks. So she was 12 weeks early. It's effectively two-thirds of the way through the process. Yeah. And to be fair, I say we were lucky. Like, it's your perception of the definition of lucky, isn't it? Like, we still had quite a bit of stress and a lot of adversity. But like, in reality, she's got no real long-term ailments. Like, she was born with this thing called congenital talipes, where her feet were literally pointing inwards like that, like fully inwards. And I was really worried. If that was anything I was worried about, I was thinking, Christ, is she going to be able to walk? And the nurse, like, more or less laughed at me and said, this is the least of your issue. Her feet will be fixed before she's even walking, so don't worry about that. But she did have a little hole in her heart as well, in her heart valve, sorry, like a tiny one. And the doctor just basically said, her breathing's quite stable, her oxygen's okay, so it's obviously not bothering her too much. And they said, truth be told, she's so small right now that trying to get in there and operate is probably too big a risk. We can leave it till she's a little bit older. She had that procedure when she was about 15 months old. And again, like, the certain times in life, you'll meet people that are so good and confident in what they do that you're just in complete awe of them. And I remember this consultant coming in, like, Eliza was about 15 months old, so she wasn't quite walking yet, but she was like up on her feet and stuff, and did this little kind of cage kind of thing in the hospital where we were sat in the waiting room on the ward. And he came up to us and basically said, I'm going to be doing the procedures today. I've done this about 600 times. I'll be in and out in about 15, 20 minutes. You've nothing to worry about. And we were both like, just felt so comfortable that this guy was an absolute expert at what he was doing. And to be fair, like, it was fine. She went down, had the operation, came back within 20 minutes. She was like playing with her toys and laughing and on her feet. And it was incredible, to be fair. But yeah, we'll go more into the kind of the whole stay on the neonatal ward, because 72 days. It was quite arduous, to say the least.
Yeah. Let's stick on this track, because I was, and we'll get to learn more about Liam as well and the sort of person that you are as we continue talking. But I was reading your blog on this a little bit earlier, actually, before we jumped on. And there was one part where you try and think about what it would be like to be in your shoes as a parent. And there was one part, actually, where just after Eliza was born, where you'd written on the blog, I was on my own in a birthing room. There's no missus, no baby. And that's probably the most lost I've ever felt in life.
Yeah.
I was asked to go up and meet Eliza a few hours later. When I first met her, she was covered in wires, bleeping machines around her. If you've not seen a premature baby before, it's quite something. And the nurse warned me of how early she was and asked me to take each day as it comes. It hit me like a sledgehammer. I don't want to take you back too far, but what is that feeling like? Because I read that. And look, I'm an emotional guy anyway. I cry at pretty much everything, basically. And I was reading that this morning. I was like, God, that must have been shit. One of the worst feelings you're gonna have, that, isn't it?
Do you know what it is, mate? And I'm not a control freak by any stretch, but I like to be able to influence things. And for me, it was, so the initial bit was the loneliness. Like I was literally telling this story to a friend of mine yesterday. He was asking about it. And the initial feeling was, so when she came early, she came out and she was crying and something like, oh, she's crying, that's a really good sign. And they literally got her out. And within 5 seconds, she was in this little clear plastic bag, just with a little head popping out. And they said, we need to keep her warm. Then they put her on this little tray heating thing. There was 13 medical professionals in the room at the time. And then they whisked her off within 5 minutes, they'd whisked her off to the neonatal intensive care unit. Me and Philip were like just fucking bag of nerves, absolutely battered. And then the midwife said, you've not delivered your placenta yet because you're so early, it's still attached. And you've got to go down to the theatre, be put under, and we've got to get that out. And it's sort of longer to get that out than it did to get Eliza out because she was so little.
Yeah.
We don't have to go into graphic detail, but to pass a baby that's that big, relative, I'm not going to say easy. Jesus Christ, if there's any mums listening, they'll be kicking the shit out of me. It wasn't easy, but if you can imagine delivering a 2 pound baby compared to an 8 pound baby, it's a very different procedure. So she was out relatively quickly. Then they whisked Philippa off to theatre for her placenta. And I remember I was stood in the room on my own. There was like a little bit of blood on the floor from when Eliza would come out, and there was like bloody tools like all over the place and stuff. And I just stood there on my own. There was no nurses or anybody, no doctors. It was literally me in the room. And I was like, now what do I do? And I remember I may as well ring one of the lads and let them know that the baby's there, because they all knew, or my close mates knew I was in hospital.
Yeah.
So I rang my mate. And I was relatively, before I picked the phone, I was quite calm and controlled. And then when I rang him, like I just cried my eyes out. I was like, she's here. And he said, she's here. I was like, yeah. He's fuck, like, how? And I said, she's just come out, mate. She's come out early. They've taken her away. I don't know what's going on. And he was like, fucking hell, mate. And I could sense the kind of hopelessness and powerlessness in his voice as well. And I think I sat there for about half an hour. And then the nurse came back down and said, as you're ready, do you want to come and meet your baby? And it was when she took my hands, like she held my hands and was like, your daughter's really early. And I was like, what does that mean? And I was speaking to a guy last week. And he's got this thing called the Dad Pad, which is basically an app and a pack for new dads. You'd actually really like this guy. I'll try and introduce you to him. But he's getting this thing out to new dads where it basically gives you some sort of tools for being a dad from day one. Really useful thing he's trying to push out in the NHS. But I was telling him about it, and he said, what she should have really done is said, this is what's happened, this is what's going to happen, and these are the likely outcomes, rather than just say, yeah, she's really early, like you should be panicked. And I did like shit myself a little bit at the time, thinking, what's she implying by she's really, I know she's really rare, but what does that mean? Is there a percentage chance she put against her or anything like that? And then when we got to meet like the rest of the nursing team, in fairness, like they were amazing. Like I didn't see the same nurse from the one that very first introduced me to Eliza. I didn't see her again, but the rest of them were really lovely. Like to the point where we go back to the ward every Christmas, and I didn't even realize at the time, but the nurses have to pay for their own fucking tea and coffee, which I think is an absolute piss take. So every Christmas, we go up there, and we'll go to the supermarket and just spend 30, 40 quid on a load of nice biscuits and teas and coffees and stuff, because they have to buy it themselves. So we go up every year and take Eliza and Margot back. And Eliza's not far off the height of some of the shorter nurses now. She's obviously, I'm 6'7", so she's massive as well. She's only just turned 8, and she's nearly 5 foot tall. And they're just like, I cannot believe that's that little baby that sat on this ward for 2.5 months. It's unbelievable, to be honest, mate. But yeah, it was a real hopelessness and powerlessness are the two words that come to mind when you say it, because you just, you don't know what to expect. And I'd never seen a premature baby before. And I don't often show pictures to people of her when, of the day she came, because it's not like looking at a normal term baby. Like normal babies, sometimes a little bit chubby, got like bright pink skin, like their eyes are fully formed. And Eliza, because she was so early, like her skin was like kind of half translucent, so you could see a lot of her blood vessels underneath her skin. Like she had dead little tiny beady eyes. Everything was just like a hand. Like if I put my little finger out, she'd be able to not get a whole hand around my little finger. That's how small her hand was. And like, because she was in an incubator, we couldn't touch her anywhere. They were like, you can't touch her. We've got to keep her in this incubator. We've got to keep all the air sanitized and everything else. It was an absolute sledgehammer to becoming a new dad, mate, to put it politely.
Not the experience on the movies, is it? Did they, I imagine, so Philip had probably stayed in for a little bit after Eliza was born, what, a couple of days or something. But I guess you were pretty much up and down to the hospital every day for...
Yeah, that was it, mate. Yeah, so she had... I think she was in overnight on the first night, and I kept on the chair next to her.
Yeah.
So I wanted to make sure that she'd recovered from the operation to get the placenta out. And then we went home and got cleaned up and came back. And then that was it for 72 days, mate. It was like Groundhog Day. Like what we'd done, we were living in Huddersfield just before she came. And then we knew we wanted to move to Leeds, but we hadn't found a place to live yet. So we sold our house. We moved in with Philippa's dad. At the time, he lived on Saddleworth Moor in a little village. So we lived there for a few months, and obviously not expecting it. We expected to have bought the new house in Leeds, moved in, decorated it and got it all ready. But obviously, Eliza had other plans. That then became Groundhog Day. So the daily routine after that was, I had about 2 weeks paternity time, which in reality is pointless. Like you may as well have none if you're having 2 weeks, especially if they're in bloody hospital for two and a half months. But my routine became, because I was living over there, I was working in Leeds City Centre. So I was up at 5 to avoid the traffic, on the road for R5 to get across to Leeds. I'd get in the office for about 7-ish. Couldn't start work till 8, so have a coffee and just chill out for an hour. I was on the phones, again, doing advice for life insurance at the time. So I'd work through till about 7 o'clock in the evening. So you get clients on an evening, because nobody worked from home back then. And also I wanted to avoid the M62 on the way back to Halifax. It's Halifax Hospital where she was at. So 7 o'clock, I'd leave the office. I'd get to Calderdale Hospital for about 8 o'clock. I'd get maybe an hour and a half with Eliza till 8, half 9. I'd sit and watch her. I'd speak to the nurses and ask how she'd done. Philippa was usually there as well. And then 9:30, I'd go on, quickly cook something to eat. Mackie's got heavily invested in at the time because I just didn't have the energy to cook anything. So we just smashed the Mackies next to the hospital for most days. And then I was in bed for 10:30, shattered, and then get up again at 5 and just repeat. And Philippa didn't miss a day. Every day she'd go and see her. And I think towards the end, I missed maybe 2 days where I was just so tired. I'd literally drive home and just get into bed because I was exhausted. And I felt horrible, like thinking she's been in that fucking hospital all day. You can't even go and see her for an hour. But I literally got to the point where I was borderline hallucinating because it was just pure exhaustion. And that was the routine, mate, for 72 days. That was it. Just rinse, repeat, rinse, repeat, rinse, repeat. And in fairness, I don't want to paint a pretty picture because it is obviously a massively stressful time, but I think there was only maybe 1 or 2 days in that whole 72 day process where the nurses were like, oh, she's not had a great night last night, her oxygen's dropped a little bit. And anyone that's spent any time in an intensive care unit or a neonatal one will know all the beeps and stuff that are going off and you get to know what they all mean. And they call it desatting, where if your oxygen drops below 90% saturation, something's obviously going wrong. And then it'll go like beep and you're like, fuck, like what's going on? And then the nurse will come in and she'll turn the oxygen up a little bit and it'll come back up and you're like, okay, thank God for that. And you just, that sound, like every time we walk back there, you just hear that noise and it's just fucking harrowing. You're just thinking, oh, bloody hell. It takes you right back to... Yeah, exactly that, mate.
I don't remember this too vividly. I just remember it. I remember it happening, but I don't remember. I was only kind of 11, 12. I remember my nephew was... So Eliza was what, £2.08 or something?
£2.05.
I think Ollie was similar. It might have even been £2.03. Anyway, he was like broadly similar. And I remember his heart stopping in, they call it, is it NICU they call it, right?
Yeah.
but his heart stopped. And I just remember this nurse coming in, as casual as it gets, and just like massaging his heart with a little finger, and he just went back in again.
I was watching it like, what the fuck? How are you so calm?
Brother's sat there with his son, like basically his heart stopped, he's £2.5 or something. And this
was early as well then?
Yeah, he was 26, 28 weeks. He was roughly around the same time as Eliza, mate, to be honest. It was very similar. And I just remember him walking in, like massaging his heart with a little finger and just walking off again, going, he's absolutely fine. And it's like the level of, for them, it's obviously second nature, isn't it? But the job they're doing is outrageous.
No, mate, you'll never hear me speak down about nurses. And I know people generally don't because they are absolute legends for what they do. But like, how are they just, I don't know how they keep calm, because I know it's not their baby. I know it's work, but it's still a life and it's still a family there. And the amount of times that we'd be just fucking lost and they'd come up to you and give you a hug, they'd go get you a cup of tea. You're like, fucking, I should be making you a cup of tea. You're looking after my baby all day. You know what I mean? You feel like a proper knob. And even like little things like towards the end of it, where she was like getting ready to be able to come home, they came up to me and said, Friday night, we want you and Philippa to go out into Leeds. So fucking get yourself a table booked and go and have a nice bite to eat because you've had such a shit time for 2 months. And I thought, who even thinks to say that? Just genuinely give a shit about everybody's welfare that was there. I couldn't speak highly enough. Absolute legends they are.
It's not a job to them, is it?
No.
It's just life, isn't it? It's just...
Yeah. I honestly think, I know it sounds dead cliche, but I think you have to be almost born to do that role. And then again, we won't go into too much fucking politics because it's probably not the platform for it. But like when you hear about how shit the NHS gets treated, you just think, fucking hell, man, shit out.
Yeah. When you mention that thing around tea and coffee, you just go, that is almost...
Car parking as well. Like they give us a permit for the car park because they basically said on day one, you're going to be here for a long time. And it was like, I don't know, £8 a day for car park. And I thought, well, that's £56 a week. So that's, if we're in for 10 weeks, that's £560. And obviously we're in for, how many weeks was it? 11 weeks. But they said, you've got this permit, just stick it in your window and then you can park wherever. And I said, oh, do you park in that car park? I'm like, no, we can't park in there. If you do, it's £5 a day for us. They make the fucking nurses pay for parking. They're like, yeah, we park on the road outside about 400 or 500 yards and have to walk up, otherwise we have to pay. And I was like, Jesus Christ, what a complete dog shit situation.
Yeah, it's mad, isn't it?
Unreal. Fucking pay for parking. Yeah, service baby's life, but make sure you pay your £8 before you come in, please.
Also, you had such a grind of a day. So stressful. And then you're
having to
your car at 10.
Yeah, like, pissing down in with the rain at fucking in the middle of Halifax, but 11 o'clock at night. Honestly, mate, we could go on forever about this and I could rant all day about it. Boils your piss to think about, to be fair.
It does irritation, doesn't it? Irritation.
Yeah, it does, mate. Yeah, it does.
So thankfully, Eliza is how old now?
She's 8. She turned 8 in December. Yeah, she's huge now, mate. You'd look at her now and think there's no way you were ever 2 pounds in weight.
Yeah,
she's absolutely massive. Like she's starting to get into sport now. So she plays footy. I'm not sound like a prick. She's probably not a natural footballer, but she really enjoys like the social aspect of sport. And like me and Mrs. both played sport as well. So we've always encouraged them just because all of our best mates are people we've played sport with over the years. So she's really getting the social bug of sport. So she plays footy. She plays netball. Trying to get into golf a little bit. I was having a laugh with the other. I met one of the dads at the range at the weekend and we were saying like, this is the sport to get him into. At this age, we left it far too late to start golf. So trying to get her into golf a little bit. She did gymnastics for a while, but again, like she's like me, she's massive. So
yeah,
she's like, it probably isn't for me. So she sat gymnastics off and then obviously swimming as well. But yeah, she's bang into it now.
Whilst we're talking about skills on every podcast where we do these kind of dad stories and everything else, we ask dads to give a question to the next guest that appears on the show. And the last question we got for you was, what's the one skill that you think you lack that you wish you would have had as a dad?
That's an interesting question. One skill that I lack.
Before this recording, we said, oh, it's just a nice informal chat, Liam. There's no pressure. And then he drops like really random.
I know, fuck it. Now dropped a bomb on me there. So one skill that I wish I had.
Or a behavior. We'll give you a behavior as well.
Patience.
Mate, mine's the same.
I would say patience.
Yeah.
Because I've we've gone through a bit of a discovery phase in the last 12 months where one of Eliza's special educational needs coordinators at the school said, I've noticed some kind of ADHD / autistic traits in Eliza. And we were like, all right. Like, we thought, yeah, there's probably something going on there, but didn't think too much of it. And we said, well, what do you think we should do? She said, nothing. Like, she's sociable, she's intelligent, it's not holding her back at school. So we'll keep an eye on her. And then we're like, okay. And then we struggled to regulate her emotions quite a lot. Like, little things would really send her into a bit of a frenzy, getting pissed off about things that wouldn't bother most people, ironically, would bother me. So we kept denying it. We pushed the school a bit more and said, we've noticed a few things outside of school that we think make sense with what you've said. What's the next steps? And then at the time, the school just didn't do anything about it. We had to nag and nag. And then eventually we wrote to the headmaster and said, headmaster, that sounds old school, head teacher, and said, are you flagged this or your teacher flagged this? And we've done nothing since. So we want a bit of support. And in fairness, since then, they've been really good. But they more or less said, yeah, she's probably not autistic, but she's almost certainly got some form of ADD or ADHD. Then I did a bit of my own research and I managed to find a book called How Not to Murder Your ADHD Child, which I thought was quite a funny title.
I thought
if that's what the author's with a bit of a dark sense of humor, I'll probably relate to this book a little bit. So I read the book and the opening sentence of the book was, first of all, well done for picking this up. You've obviously recognized that something's going on with your child in some sort of neurodivergence and you want to do something to equip you better as a parent. So a pat on the back. And then it said, secondly, if you're a parent of an ADHD child, there's as much correlation as there is between passing on height and eye color. So they said, almost certainly one or both of you will have ADHD.
Wow.
And I was like, never really give it any thought. And then when you read about the traits of people with ADD and ADHD and neurodivergence, you're like, okay, I do that. Then I read it, and they were like, go and take this simple test on like psychology.org. And it's like a 60-part multiple choice quiz. She said, it's not a foolproof thing. Like, it's not going to guarantee that you have or haven't got it. But if you answer all these questions honestly and you score highly, then there's probably a very strong chance that you fall into that category. So me and Mrs. went and did this test. And I said to her, like, sat in the living room, I was like, how'd you get on? She said, I got like 12 out of 60. And I thought, oh, that's not very high. And then I did it. I got like fucking 48. And I was like, Jesus Christ. And then I was like, okay, what does this mean? And then I did a load of reading. It was like, struggle to emotionally regulate. And I was like, I think I'm all right with that. Then like, organization. Philip was like, you are fucking awful with organization.
Yeah.
And she's just, Eliza's like a little carbon copy of me. She's actually exactly the same. And then we'll wind each other up, me and Eliza. Like, she'll do things that she'll know will piss me off. So she'll do them again and again. I'm like, why are you doing this just to wind me up? And Philip was like, Liam, you're 38. She's 8. Yeah, but she knows what she's doing. We'll get into it and we'll start riling each other up. She's just, because she knows exactly how to press my buttons. If she's in a fucking mood, she will press the buttons exactly as she knows to do. Yeah, patience would be the one I would go for, I think, mate.
Isn't that mad, Harold? Because I'm seeing that with my little man already. He's 4 and little moments where he knows exactly what to do.
Yeah.
Certain points just to go have a bit of that. And just watching you react. And so I'm really trying. I said exactly the same, patience. I was like, so I just don't have any. And I really want to have it. Like we make a conscious effort not to shout around the kids. Like, we don't want to just be that kind of house, but it's fucking hard at times, isn't it?
It really is, mate. Yeah. And this is a big thing that I try and talk about, like with other dads and that, is that don't beat yourself up when you do that. That's the biggest thing I've learned to myself. Like, obviously, you don't want to be screaming in your kids' ear 7 days a week because you fucking God knows what sort of psychological damage you're going to do. But if you lose your shit and you're like, just go to your room or do whatever, like, as long as you recognize that that's on you and you fuck that up, and then you're like, right, okay, why has it happened? Why did I not have the right amount of patience? What's going on in my head? What's going on in my world? A lot of stress at work, fucking stress with money. You're tired. You're out of shape. You've not done the right fucking things to get your day going in the routine and everything else. And right, okay, next time I'll make sure I do this, that, and the other. As long as you're actively trying to improve as a dad, for me, I don't think you should beat yourself up too much.
No, I agree. Kids are smart as well, aren't they?
Yeah, very, mate, very, very. I think people underestimate that. Like, and everyone says, oh, she's so switched on, but then you're like, fucking no, you've really switched on. Really switched on. Like, they'll know exactly what to do at the right time. And a part of me thinks, I take a bit of reassurance on that, because if you're that switched on at 8, what are you going to be like when you're 18, 19, 20? And I notice it more. My youngest, like Margot, has only just turned 6, but she's infinitely more switched on than even Eliza. Like, she knows exactly what she's doing at all times. Like, she's like a future CEO. Like, she'll be fucking ruling the world at some point when she's older, because she wraps her sister around her finger as well.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Me and Philip are on top. She's the alpha in the house, that little bugger.
It's the second ones, isn't it? Second ones are crazy as well, aren't they?
Yeah. I think they learn a lot from the eldest, and then they fast track because they get taught these things all the time. And obviously, Eliza had no one to socialize with growing up, apart from me and Philippa, obviously. But we're not kids, and we'll teach a certain thing. But like, them two spend so much time together, which is good. Like, they play really well together. But obviously, she's seen how Eliza acts and seen what she does, and she'll know certain things. Like, and to be fair to Margot, Eliza's, since school, have changed things and put things in place. Eliza comes home from school much more relaxed than she used to. Like, she used to come home and the deputy head is like the special educational needs coordinator for the south of Leeds. So she's quite switched on and she's really helpful.
Mm.
She basically said to me, if you imagine a bottle of Coke, she said, like, at 9:30 when something pisses Eliza off in class, that Coke will get shaken and then left. And then at midday when she's late getting a dinner for whatever reasons, it'll get shaken again and again and again. By the time she gets home, that bottle's fucking ready to blow up. And then she'll come home, open the lid and go. She goes, so I said, well, how do we counter that then? She goes, right, what we can do in school is certain things. We did this like sensory profile for her, and she likes like them poppet toys. So school literally bought her a poppet. So she sits and pops that like in her hand when she's doing a reading and whatever else. She's got a little wobble cushion because she's always like fidgeting on a chair and stuff like that. You probably see me doing it during this, to be fair, spinning around and whatnot. So they put that in there for her. It sounds minor, but because their brain works differently, like, it just calms her down. So she was, at one point, mate, she was coming home from school and having a full-on screaming meltdown. I'd say 4 days out of five, we were like, this is fucking unbearable. Give you a good life. You've got bloody playroom, bloody PS5 to play on. There's like loads of shit to go and do. You have all these kids clubs. It's not like you can't get rid of any energy, like you're a busy kid. And we just got fucking exhausted. And since they've put them things in place, like, she's been infinitely better when she gets home, and quite nice to be around again, to be fair.
Did you lose heart as a parent when all that stuff was going on?
Yeah, massively, mate, yeah. Because I sit back and think about me as a kid, and you always do that, don't you? Think, fucking, I didn't get this when I was a kid. My mum was fucking hard as nails, and they used to beat me up, but fucking hell, if I was out of line, I'd know about it when he came home from work. I'd be fucking dreading the car pulling up. And then, but I never really was. Like, I was quite a good kid. Like, I was quite well behaved. My mum always says you were a really good young lad. Like, you were never really in any bother. You worked hard at school and stuff, and you're always grateful and polite. And to be fair, the kids are polite. Grateful sometimes, I think. But you think, we've given you so much, and you can't just come home and be nice and kind and fucking a pleasure to be around at times. And it does. It makes you think, where have we fucked up here? Have we done too much for them? Have we not done enough over here? Have we not spent enough time with this or that or the other? And you do question yourself, mate, but I just think it's a generational thing, isn't it? Like, every generation that occurs argues, like, I remember my dad saying, Christ, I didn't get all this when I was a kid. And it's just rinse and repeat, isn't it? Just 25 years down the line.
And it's all relative, isn't it? Because we definitely didn't have all this as a kid. Then you go, we're actually pretty happy that it wasn't that bad.
Yeah, I had quite a good upbringing, to be fair, mate. Like, I've not got any real childhood trauma or anything like that. Like, we lived a modest life, but we grew up in a little town halfway between Hull and York, or Market Wheaton. It's probably, at the time, there's probably about 5,000 people live there. So it had like a few pubs, post office, primary school, secondary school, and that was literally about it. But it was quite a safe place. There was never any crime. Like, we didn't witness any crime at all. And that's the thing. Like, we're growing up in Leeds now. Like, I'll fire up Instagram, it'll be like, mum of two found murdered Neddingley. Like, fucking hell, like, it's a bit strong. You become numb to it. But like, going back to that, like, where I grew up was quite nice. It's quite calm. We didn't have any money. Like, my old man was a prison officer. Mum didn't work for a long time when we were growing up. She wanted to be around us and look after us. So we didn't really have a lot, but we didn't go without. We went on holiday abroad every couple of years and always had nice Christmases and things like that. So yeah, I wouldn't have said I went without, but wouldn't have said I was spoiled or anything either.
It always felt different though, Liam. Like, when we were kids, we just had a group of mates, football down at the field all day, like midday till like 7-8 o'clock at night, and you would never go home, would you?
Nope.
And now it's where the kids, if the kids were like, obviously mine are too young at the moment, so I don't feel this, but you probably see it when they're going out with friends, you're like, they've been out 2 hours on the earth from them, what's going on?
Doesn't even happen, mate, in my house. Doesn't happen. If they're going to go out with mates, it'll be, I'll drive you to your mate's house. It'll be a pre-arranged play date. We stay there while you're there and have a coffee. And then
I'm outside having a Mackey's.
Yeah.
weird.
Or even in the street, they'll only go on the street on their bikes if I'm like on the driveway cleaning the car, or if I take them out. And they're only 8 and 6, but that's the thing. Like where I grew up, we had a little cul-de-sac, but I knew every house. I knew who lived on every single house in the cul-de-sac. There might have been 30 houses on the cul-de-sac or 40. I knew every single person. And I'd go and knock on for the kids and we'd bugger off, like you said, till it got dark and you'd come home. Probably even 8-year-old, like Elijah's age, I definitely would have been out, and we used to have a little wood round the back and we'd jump over the fence and walk down the woods and we'd piss about in the trees and stuff. Fucking not a chance for a little Elijah to do that now.
No, kicking lumps out of each other, weren't you?
Yeah.
It's crazy. I want to talk about a topic that isn't dry at all before we wrap up. Life insurance, Liam. It's where the fun begins, right?
Get yourself strapped in.
Get yourself, calm yourself down. But on a serious note, I mean, it's important, isn't it? And there's probably dads listening to this. And I think it's just something to cover for dads who are thinking about this stuff. I only got it last year. And so at kind of 34, 35 at that point, just felt like it was something you needed to do. But I don't really understand it. I didn't really understand like the premiums. I didn't really understand what I was getting or what I needed to get in terms of payout and all that sort of stuff. Other things that dads should look out for in terms of like 3-5 tips that can help them figure this stuff out, or some of the things that they absolutely need to think about when they're doing this stuff?
To be honest, mate, truthfully, there's only one tip you need, and I'm going to sound a little bit biased here, but it's speak to an advisor. And I'm not saying me, but get advice on it. There's a reason why it's regulated. There's a reason why there's qualifications to give advice. I can't speak for the entire country, but most places that I know, there's no fee for any advice either.
Yeah.
And all you'll get in that with that service is if you go and do it yourself on comparethemarket.com and you do the health questionnaire and you get it wrong, and this has happened to a client of mine before, then the insurer has every right to not pay that policy out because you've put the wrong details on the health form. So I had a client 2 months ago. And she said, I've already done it. And I said, all right, tell me what you've got. And I'll have a look at it. I think it's perfect. I say to her, I can't afford it. I can't afford it. You're exactly right where you are. She sent me it over. And that'll be in the family. We don't have a conversation about our health insurance. And me, she said, I'm not going to be a person. I said, we'll be right back.
in my head, it feels like one of those tasks where you're going, oh, I'm going to get loads of paperwork. I'm going to have to do it. I'll put it off.
People.
Yeah.
Yeah. So again, like, can't speak for everybody, but the way I go about my day is I'm generally quite quiet 10 till 2.
Yeah.
But then I make myself available 7, 8, 9 at night because most people I speak to are dads.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what have you got on today? I'm working till 6. And then obviously, got kids to feed, kids to put to bed. Okay, how are you at half eight? What, you can work at half eight? Well, yeah, if you've got an hour free at half eight, mate, let's have it done. Like I did one on a few weeks ago with a bloke on Teams and he sat there with a couple of tins of beer and we just sat for an hour and chatted it through and ended up getting him sorted. But he was like, oh, do you know what? It's so nice to just be able to do this in my own house, like on video call with a pint of beer in my hand. Like, it's easy enough, easy to do.
What happened when we asked him how many units he drank a week?
Yeah, I was like, you got to be honest here.
He's got no chance of playing it. I don't drink, mate. I'm fine.
Yeah. I've got a video call recording that proves you do. Yeah. But time's the biggest one, mate. And often budget as well. Again, I don't get too technical, but if you go through your bank for your mortgage, which most people do, most of the banks will quote you a top end product. Mm. Not products, because the bank's products are usually not as comprehensive as what you can get through an advisor, but they'll quote you like, if you've got a 200 grand mortgage, they'll say 200 grand of critical loss cover, that's 183 quid a month. And you're like, can hell, my mortgage is only 700. Whereas an advisor will say, okay, we can do something with this. We don't have to completely ignore critical loss cover. But what we can do is say, let's cover a year's worth of your outgoings or 2 years in case you get cancer. A lot of people that do get cancer might go and have surgery or treatment, and within 9 months, they might be back on their feet and back to work.
Yeah.
So for a lot of people, it's working out their budget, what's right for them, just to make sure it fits in the right space, so to speak.
Yeah, that makes sense. We'll share, I know we're not necessarily here to talk about this stuff and you didn't want to dwell on it too much, but we'll share your details after this when it goes out. And then if dads want to get in touch, you can do as well, right?
Yeah, it's been a pleasure, mate.
Awesome. Okay, how are you feeling after telling the story?
Yeah, good, mate. Yeah, it's good to talk. I spent a lot of years not speaking about it, to be honest. I did. And then, obviously, I've started a podcast back end of last year, but I've not put any pressure to rattle out a load of episodes. I've only done two and a half so far. The first one we did, I talked about this, and it was quite an emotional thing because I spent years just not discussing it, truthfully, which is never a good thing. Like, you're meant to talk about stuff that's on your mind, but I think because it was so intense, that kind of pressure cooker, I just packed it down and packed it down and packed it down. But no, it's good to talk about it. And the more I talk about it, the easier it does become to talk about as well.
Yeah. I think the other thing is you got this, I don't know about you, but I always, especially with emotional stuff, you don't feel like people always really give a shit because they've got their own things going on. So I generally don't talk to friends about stuff, Aubrey, because you're just like, well, everyone else got shit to get on.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I've said that myself before, like everyone has got their own shit to deal with. And you think, you don't want to offload on them and then just add a bit more to their plate. But then, like I said, I've had an hard couple of years, to be honest, with work and everything else. And I've not burdened myself on other people. I've had mates that know I've had a fucking hard year and been like, come on, right, we're off for a pint, we're off to go and do something.
Yes.
You know, for me, that's where the dads can pick each other up, because if you recognise one of your pals has his head up his arse, just literally say, come on, we'll go driving range, we'll go for a pint, we'll go for a walk. And that's as good as any therapy for me. Like, it's just getting your head out of in the clouds and stretching your legs and just chatting through to them. And sometimes you don't even have to speak. You can just go out and you can do something totally different, but just getting your head into a different space for an hour does you a lot of good, doesn't it?
It does, mate. It feels like it. And I'm going to hold you to an offer of going for a walk and a beer as well. Actually, it'd be good to get together at some point and have
it. Yeah, definitely, mate. I'm speaking to a few blokes. I'm going to get one organized for the summer, first springtime. We'll go up to the lakes for a couple of hours and get up one of the mountains and have a few beers at the top.
Yeah, let's do it. Yeah, sounds good. Awesome. Buddy, thank you for joining us. Thanks for sharing all that as well. I appreciate it. I know it's not always easy. And
my pleasure, mate.
We'll see you kicking around the community as well, no doubt. All right?
Definitely, mate. Definitely. Much appreciated.
Top man. Cheers, Liam.
Cheers, buddy.
Dads, thank you so much for listening to the Dadversity podcast. A usual request from these things, if you could hit subscribe or follow wherever you listen to your podcast, to help grow the audience, that would be amazing. We have got some big plans for Dadversity. The intention is to start bringing in coaches that can deliver courses to dads that hopefully are going to get funded via different companies that we're going to be partnering with to help you as dads solve some of the challenges that you're facing in your life currently. So we are motoring forward to try and create the world's first university for dads.
So your support, any follows, any shares would be massively appreciated. And you can follow Dadversity on all the usual channels. Mostly we spend our time on TikTok. And if you need to reach out or you want to appear on any podcast, then drop me an email. It's nathan@dadversity.co.uk.